Welcome to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, and I'm your host, Jerry Alexander. This show is all about commercial property investing for the private investor. Whether you're just getting started or scaling up your portfolio, through interviews, tips and lessons learned along the way, we want to give you the inspiration, knowledge and confidence to enjoy this great cash flowing strategy. Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast. We recently recorded an awesome podcast about valuations with a super knowledgeable surveyor, Ryan Stevens. But there is another side to Ryan. He's also a commercial property investor. So we're not talking about the dark side today of valuation, but we're moving into the light. Right, Ryan? Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me back.
It's great to have you. Thank you. And I'm really looking forward to hearing of your story, how you got into industrial and what you've been doing in the commercial market. Because I think from our listeners' point of view, it's always so super important to listen to people that are investing. But those that also have a foot in the professional camp really gives great insight from both sides of the dark side and the light side, right?
Indeed. So. It depends which one's the dark side, though, you know, the honest surveying work or the nasty landlord side.
That's right. Well, it's all about perspective, right? Yeah. So maybe we should do a bit of context, just run through maybe a little bit about your property journey so far. And I believe you maybe started off resi. Maybe you could just talk through some of those experiences so far, Ryan, just to give people an idea of what you're up to.
Yeah, so a very quick précis of my life, as it were, post-18. So I went to university, studied effectively property, did a surveying degree 2004 through 2008, graduated, got a job with Heineken, got made redundant because the global recession was happening. Top and bottom, it became a chartered surveyor in 2010 in October, and almost to within a few weeks of that, I bought my first residential investment property. So that was just a straight up, two up, two down, mid-terraced house for £43,000 in sunny Doncaster. And then 6 months later, went and bought a three-bed end terraced on the same street for £37,000.
So you. Right.
So we then thought we'd been screwed over on the first one, because that was only two bedrooms. So we overpaid for the first property. So being a chartered surveyor doesn't tell you everything. Anyway, jokes aside, so that was, you know, back in October 2010, moving forward. And then over the course of a few years, you know, bought more and more resi properties, then started buying properties to turn them into HMOs. That was around 2013-ish. Did a few more and more HMOs. And then in 2018, got the opportunity, this was August 18, got the opportunity to buy a quasi off-market industrial estate in Sheffield. And then basically just stuck to industrial from there. We'll maybe talk about maybe the off-market stuff later.
Yeah, of course,
It wasn't absolutely off-market, you know.
There were some particulars drawn up, I'm assuming, but there was probably some particulars drawn up, but they weren't out there readily for everybody. They were being sent
exactly.
around the surveying bodies.
It wasn't on Rightmove, there wasn't a board on the front of the building. It was put out to a list of people who the agents knew would and could complete on the property without too much of a fuss.
But one of those was you.
It was indeed, fortuitously. It was a bit of a dog's dinner. And then, you know, went and bought another property that we sort of completely knocked back to brick. The most recent acquisition was a sort of fairly nice investment, pretty much an asset management job only.
Right.
So no real work. And then we bought that in October through Allsops Auction.
Nice. Okay. Oh, I'm looking forward to talking about that one as well. So One was the dog's dinner and need a lot sorting out. Another one was back to brick. And then another one is more asset management. That's great. So maybe we'll talk about each of those, right? So it's interesting you're talking about deals and where they came from. So one came kind of under the market between agents. The one that was the back to brick, how did that come to you?
That was straight up on the market.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Rightmove. Advertised with Knight Frank, you know, I don't think they're the biggest, but certainly one of the biggest commercial agents in the world, certainly in the UK. You know, so just a big, you know, been on the market for 6 months, nobody had touched it.
Everybody could see it. Yeah.
Yeah. Quite frankly, you know, and I have told the agent this, so if he happens to be listening to this, it'll not come as a shock. But it was badly advertised.
Right.
It was just badly advertised. There were three photos. It was a real mess inside the property. The former, it was an owner occupier. It was a shed factory, and there were nigh on 1,000 sheds in there. And quite frankly, I mean, there's a massive story behind this. I'll not bore everyone with it, but literally, like with a week to go, we thought we were going to end up with 1,000 sheds. they had made no attempt whatsoever to clear this place out, yeah. And I was ringing people saying,
"Do you want a shed?
Yeah, how do I get rid of these? How do I literally get rid of 1,000 sheds? Because you know, sort of 2 days after completion, we've got lads turning up wanting to do the electrics, and we've got then 3 days after that, we've got the builders turning up. So that was a whole thing. But anyway, just sort of that's probably a conversation.
So this one was on Knight Frank, and you've covered maybe why partly the reason why it didn't sell. The agent was maybe not promoted right.
No floor plans, you know, poorly advertised, and probably. From the agent's point of view, I think he sort of probably came to realise afterwards the ability and an appetite for these small little tiddly industrial units from an occupier's point of view and from a tenant's perspective. I think because he'd worked, you know, he'd done his placement year in Knight Frank and then been, you know, gone on to be a graduate surveyor and what have you. His head was up here. Mm-hmm. It was up in the clouds. Basically, anything below 500,000 square foot is peanuts.
Yes,
and you know, and who on earth would want to deal with that? Because that's just too below me.
Yes.
And there are people who want 500 square foot. You know, I mean, this was 20,000 square foot that we cut into 17 unit.
Right. Listen, we've already started talking about this, so let's just dive into this one. We'll come to the third one and the first one, right? Because I've got questions here. So 17 units, that's a great strategy. I've done that myself, taking a warehouse and splitting it down. Did you end up doing completely separate units, or did you have communal services? How did you actually do that division?
So they are completely independent.
Mm-hmm. Own toilets, own electric supply.
Well, no. So we've got one massive electric supply. So we as part of the upgrade, we had to pay Northern Power Grid a substantial amount of money. One thing for your listeners, never, ever underestimate how much utility companies are willing to charge.
Yes.
And by the way, just a little tidbit, you don't have to go with people like Northern Power Grid or whatever your local utilities company is. There is an official Lloyds of London approved registered contractors list that you can approach. That's a national thing. And funnily enough, we actually got a firm from Sheffield who were on this Lloyds of London approved list. They can do everything that the official company can, barring a few things. So basically, we ended up paying about 10 grand less. We ended up paying Northern Power Grid 400 quid to do the stuff that they legally have to do.
Yes, yes.
But notwithstanding that, we paid this other company, you know, a lot less than Northern Power Grid would quote. One electric supply into the building, and then everything else is sub-metered.
Okay.
Off brilliant. That, it's metermanager.co.uk, a great little firm, and it's all done by SIM card.
Okay.
So in reality, we wish we'd have put prepayment meters in. That's the only thing, again, just for your listeners.
Yeah, because if somebody does go, you are technically on the hook because it's coming through your main supply.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, we do make a little bit of profit on that each month, you know, just to be honest about it. But you can do in commercial space. With residential, you can't, obviously. There's no law prohibiting that.
What's your, I've noticed on the electric recently where the price changes. So we had one we had to review. And the standing charge gone from like 30 odd pence to £6 a day. I mean, it's nuts how those things have changed. And it's something I think to be aware of. If you're looking at some big industrial buildings with big meters, there could be quite a big ongoing standing charge.
Indeed. So at the first property we bought in August 18, that's actually got a substation on site.
Wow. Yeah.
And we've just gone a couple of months ago, gone through the process of coming out of contract. From 15 pence a kilowatt, and like I can't remember exactly what the standing charge was. It was low compared to what we're paying now. We're paying sort of 35 pence a kilowatt. That's because the supply, it's all based on the supply to the site. And the supply to that, because it's substation, is astronomical. It's massive. It's actually 1 megawatt.
Wow.
the supply to that site. It's way too much. It's just way too much. But we can't have it turned down, unfortunately. It's just not possible.
Right, okay. So these guys are on sub-meters toilets?
Yeah. So there, we had a toilet block built. Because at the back of the site, it would have been prohibitively expensive to put toilets, and putting water into the unit is dead easy. Probably, but getting the foul away is just it would have cost tens of thousands of pounds to get the correct falls on the levels and everything. And then, but as soon as you start digging down below a certain level, you have to start going into like civils grade, and that just costs 10 times as much. Yep. Once you start going into the civil engineering quality and quantity.
Yeah.
So we had a toilet block built, and then the units at the front and side of the estate, we didn't actually put the toilets in. When we dug it all up on, for the tarmac and what have you at the side, we put drains in and stubs into the unit. So if the tenant wanted, they could put their own toilet in.
Okay.
But we do have, for example, one occupier have took two units carpet storage. They do not want a toilet in there.
It
would just take space up. So that's why we put the option in there for all the occupiers. Most have gone to the trouble of putting it in, but not all for obvious reasons.
Yeah. So that's great, because that kind of CMO model means that you don't have to go and put all toilets in. I think some people expect they do, and you don't have to put another meter in. Sometimes it's prudent to do so, but the cost can be quite prohibitive, like you say. And I'm assuming that the common toilet area, the landscape and everything else goes out in a service charge on top of...
No, we don't actually run a service charge.
You don't,
on this particular site, no. Because we're aiming at small occupiers, we charge a fairly heavy rent.
Yeah.
But that includes... Now, admittedly, there's no landscaping. We pay a caretaker £200 a month, and he goes once a week and tops the toilet rolls up, gives it a quick rinse, wash down and what have you, tests the fire alarm, all that sort of stuff, and it charges effectively £50 a visit.
Yeah, excellent. Okay,
but that comes out of our pocket effectively.
So there's 17 units. What do you say the over?
Let me take a moment to thank Office R&D for supporting the podcast. It's really important to us that we only work with sponsors that we've used ourselves. It's all about being authentic, right? Office R&D is the best flexible workspace platform we've come across, and believe me, we've tried a few systems over the last 20 years. Office R&D helps us manage our invoicing, customer community, reporting, building access, and many more aspects of our day-to-day operations. Why not book yourself a free demo to see how they can help you free up more time to grow your business? Follow the partner link in the show notes.
What size was, Ryan? What's the tip?
20,000 square foot.
Right, okay. So they're between 1,000 and 1,500 square foot, or have you got various...
So a good number of them are 500 square foot.
Oh wow, okay.
So just bigger than a garage, erring towards a double garage side, and they are basically £400 a month.
Yeah,
broadly speaking, between £400 and £450 a month.
And as an occupier, they are like hen's teeth.
Yeah,
anything like that, it's really difficult. Anything sub 5,000 square foot anywhere in the country, I think, is difficult to get.
Yeah, so they're the smaller ones. Then we've got some at 750. And then the biggest, they've got a couple at just over 2,000 square foot.
Right, excellent. Okay, thanks for that quick dive into that one. So the third project you spoke about has been more about asset management. What's the kind of size of that one?
That, weirdly, again, is 20,000 square foot.
Right, magic number.
yeah, exactly. So this is the one we bought through Allsops.
Yes.
It was a little bit of a faff around to buy it, because it's actually a long leasehold property, so it's not freehold.
Okay. Okay.
So when we bought it, there were 88 years left on the lease. The freeholder was painful to deal with. So we bought this in October. Last week, we finished the process of extending the lease from 80, what was remaining of 88 years back up to 125, which was the original lease length. So that's 20,000 square foot. It's four units. So it's actually four fives, but we've only got three tenants, because we've got cash and carry, Euro car parts, they're taking five apiece, and then a regional bakery overtook 10,000.
Why did that go to auction?
It was basically because of the freeholder. So the lease, the long leaseholder, the guy who owned it before us, he'd bought the land on a long leasehold originally from Rotherham Council. Mm-hmm. It had then been sold and sold and sold. And anyway, the freeholder had kiboshed a number of private treaty sales before. So first of all, the cash and carry, the tenants in the cash and carry tried to buy it, and the freeholder just didn't like them. Basically, he said that they weren't secure enough.
Right.
Effectively, then they tried to sell it to another party via private treaty. Couldn't, because the freeholder kiboshed that. And so basically the guy was left with having to sell it in auction. And ultimately at that point, obviously, you know, once the hammer came down, we'd legally committed to it. And so the freeholders had to accept us.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it took 3 months to get there. Yeah. And quite frankly, the actual vendor was really happy with us. You know, it was like, oh, you guys are brilliant. You know, you're providing all the information the freeholder wants. So they wish they'd known about you guys before. But they were, you know, again, just word of caution to your listeners is if you ever come across a property that's long leasehold, just be cautious about who the freeholder, because they were awful to deal with.
Yeah. Well, you've managed to get there, though. You've managed to get there. So,
yeah.
So is that property fully let? Was it fully let at the time?
Yes. So, like I say, it's 20,000 square foot, 5, 5, and 10, fully rented out. So Euro car parts were on a 10-year lease from 2012. So that was the second, that was unit two.
Okay.
The other three units, effectively, the other two occupiers, were on 10-year leases from 2017.
Okay. So the car parts, have you had the conversations?
Yeah. So there was also, which we actually found out after the fact, after we bought it, there was an outstanding rent review from Euro car parts in 2017. So the first thing we did was actually do a backdated rent. So we managed to get just shy of 20 grand out of Euro car parts for backdated rent, which was quite nice.
Yes.
And yes, they want to stay. Funnily enough, they are actually going through the process of paying for a new roof themselves, completely off their own bat. So removing the old asbestos roof that is over there, part of the unit, and putting a new insulated, you know, jobby on, which is fun. That's 40 grand. And they're just paying for that themselves. You know,
that's amazing. So basically what we're talking about here is asset management. You bought a building, it's got occupants in it. There is some lease work to do.
Exactly. So as you've just started to hint at, we have already started the process with Euro car parts. So we served the Section 25 notice. So that's Section 25 of the Landlord and Tenant Act for those of us south of the wall. As it were. I appreciate you guys in Scotland have got a slightly different system. But yeah, so a friendly Section 25 notice where we effectively say we want to offer you a new lease.
It's mandatory to do it.
Yes, exactly. So, and then we've done the bakery rent review and we're just about to complete the cash and carry rent review.
Right, okay. And when you've done these, because obviously you now, maybe we should just back up for a second. Ryan, you're doing this with two partners, is that right?
Yes.
Yes. And are they also professionals in the industry?
No.
Right, okay.
No, but one of them is a builder stroke accountant. He trained as an accountant, but then ran a building firm.
Right, okay.
And the other is a he's got a doctorate in microchemistry.
Wow, okay.
Molecular chemistry.
Nice combination.
He's got a PhD in molecular chemistry.
So when you're doing this lease work, how much are you being involved, or are you giving that to somebody else to do?
All of it. It's my job. Yes. I have joked that I should put an invoice in to my own company, but no, it's me doing it, quite frankly. It has fallen to me. If I weren't involved, it would be probably quite necessary to include another surveyor.
Yeah,
because the tenants have had representation, you see.
It's a tricky process, but ultimately there is a process there that's set out and a way to do it. And did you have to get a commercial valuation to say what the market rate is right now, or were you able to agree that between yourselves without having to appoint somebody to do that?
In commercial leases, the rent review mechanism is that the landlord and the tenant, or indeed the landlord's representative and the tenant's representative, first of all, have a conversation and try and agree the rent themselves based on the comparables in the local area. Yep. So I, obviously, as landlord in this particular instance, because, you know, whilst being a surveyor, you know, I am the landlord in this particular case. I spoke to the tenant's representative, the surveyor who they appointed, and we battered back and forth about the pluses and negatives of the subject property, and indeed the pluses and negatives of all the comparables.
Yes.
In down to the minutiae, and then top and bottom of it, you come to a horse deal. It's never perfect. The backstop is always you either go to arbitration or independent expert.
Okay, that's brilliant. Right, so we've talked about asset management. So this is basically buying some already income-producing asset, which may, although you've, I'm sure you've got a good price on it, but it may be at standard kind of market rate, but you recognise that underlying there are opportunities to do some asset management through lease work to actually increase the yield and therefore potentially the value.
Yeah, yep. Well, to decrease the yield, more specifically.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, there were a few, a increase in the rent with the rent reviews. It was the first thing to do. Again, whilst this was advertised through all SOPs, I don't believe it was very well advertised, to put it bluntly. You know, I think the, I sort of half know-ish the kid who works at all SOPs. I don't ever think he's been outside the M25.
Right.
You know, it, again, he probably just thought, oh, Rotherham, meh, rubbish, crap. You know, that's, you know, that's not, that's never going to rent for any more money. £3 a square foot. Yeah, I'll put 8% on that. That'll do. Whereas in reality, we've got between £6 and £6.75 a square foot.
What was it when you got it? What was the rent's level?
It was producing 64,500, I think.
Yeah.
And then you have to minus the because there's a fairly hefty ground rent, you see. That right. That caused the problems with the freeholder. But there's a 25 grand ground rent to pay. So it's 64 grand down to 40, or just shy of 40.
Okay.
And we, once we've finished, we're expecting it to be 128.
Wow.
Minus 30 now, because we've had to pay an increased ground.
So just
rent.
Under 100, so more than double the income.
Yes.
And where are you expecting the value to go to?
Once we've renewed the lease to Euro Car Parts, who are obviously our sort of golden, you know, the jewel in the crown, if you will.
You don't have to give me the exact figure. What I mean is compared with where it was, because we've more than doubled the rent, the net rent. Does that mean we've more than doubled the net value, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we pay. I don't mind saying it, you know, because it's everything's available through land registry. So, you know, we paid £450 for it.
Mm-hmm.
We are very conservatively expecting it to be valued at £1.2 million.
Yeah.
In reasonable terms, you know, I think it's about 8% yield. In reality, there are other properties selling for 6% and so that brings it up to sort of 1.4, 1.5.
That's fantastic. And just out of interest, is that your strategy, or are you going to hold on to it?
We are intending to hold on to it. You know, the like I said, there's me and two pals. We are all sort of very income driven. Me and Dave, the microchemist, we're sort of both late-ish 30s, both got kids, and so therefore, you know, that's our driving factor. Richard's a little bit older, doesn't have kids. He's sort of in his early 50s, doesn't have kids, not going to have them. But him and his partner, you know, are very income driven because they like a certain lifestyle.
It's a great choice then, these sorts of assets. And let's run back to the first one.
Yes,
because that's a different type of proposition, right?
So that was a very different. Yeah, that was two years. So basically, we bought that in 2018. Sorry, do you want me to just sort of tell the story?
I mean, just to summarize the asset management one, the last one, I mean, for listeners, obviously, that's one you could potentially employ some professionals in the market to basically do that work for you, that asset management for you on your behalf.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, yeah. You would pay a decent fee. For a surveyor, but you know, I do, on a professional level, I do rent reviews and lease renewals and what have you, and you know, it's sometimes a bit of a long slog, but you know, you get there eventually. But we technically could just completely hands off. We do have a managing agent on the site. The thing is, again, I'm at a slight advantage, I suppose, in that I really know the market. But you know, I'm on the RICS President's Panel for arbitrations for commercial rent disputes.
Yep.
So I feel I've got a slight advantage to, you know, so it's obviously in my
negotiation.
It's in my inherent interest to get the best I can. You don't have to be a chartered arbitrator and a chartered surveyor to do this. If you want to, if you just go and have a chat with your bloody tenants, putting it frankly, you know, and if you can come to, again, it's always a horse deal at the end of it. I make no bones about it. It's always a fudge. So if you can come to a compromise that works for both of you, then happy days. Yes. You know, you don't have to go and start paying surveyors you know, £X thousand to do the job.
Okay, so that's one type of strategy, which is it's excellent we covered that. So let's go back to the slightly more the blood and the guts on the first one. So just talk us through that one, right?
So, like I say, quasi off market, we were approached by a firm of surveyors who knew that we were in the market for something industrial, something a bit dirty, you know, a bit heavy going. So this is 35,000 square foot.
Right.
It's 48 units. It's a listed building. It's an old Victorian steel mill in Sheffield. Mm-hmm. Real hodgepodge. You know, anything units from 120 odd square foot up to 3,500.
Yeah.
So absolute mishmash of all sorts of stuff. When we bought it, it was part rented. So it was producing about 70 grand a year in rent.
Yeah.
We paid 460 for that one.
Okay.
Plus VAT, which that's again a whole other, there was a whole other thing with VAT. So again, just transfer of a going concern is mm-hmm. something your listeners definitely need to look into, and whether it meets the HMRC definition. This one didn't.
Oh, interesting. And it, even though it was
and indeed, after we bought it, we tried to reclaim the 90 grand in VAT.
Yeah.
Literally, like a couple of days after we bought it, because that was the end of our VAT quarter. We did that immediately. Got to get a phone call from an investigating officer at HMRC. Can you just explain to me, Mr. Stevens, why this wasn't, you know, why you didn't just do this as a transfer of a going concern? And you have to explain, look, you know, the vendor's accountants were Deloitte.
We're adamant, yes.
Yeah, well, it's not just that, but, you know, the vendor's accountants were Deloitte. The vendor's solicitors were one of the magic, you know, one of the magic circle law firms. Our solicitors were these guys who were fairly well known in South Yorkshire. Our accountants are a big, not big, but, you know, sort of a medium-sized accountancy practice in South Yorkshire. All four of us agreed that it didn't meet your definition of a transfer of a going concern. So I'll just make a quick phone call and we'll process this refund for you. It's frustrating when things like that happen. But anyway, again, whole of the conversation. Whoever said investing was easy. So we bought it. It was part income producing. Basically, it had been left to rack and ruin effectively by not only the people we bought it off, who'd owned it for about 15 or 17 years, but also the person who'd owned it prior to them for about 10 years. The absolute bare minimum in terms of effectively just making sure the place didn't burn down. They're the only repairs that had been done. You know, the roofs were leaking, the electrics had been put in by Jesus. You know, it was just awful. Real dog's dinner. And so there were units, one of the units, for example, had been rented out by a builder who hadn't paid his rent to the previous owners, but had been doing building work and charging his clients to remove rubbish.
Oh, dear.
You know where this is going, don't you?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Wasn't paying to have the rubbish taken to a proper commercial tip where he'd have had to pay for it by weight.
Yep.
It was just dumping it in the unit that he wasn't paying for. So that is a 1,400 square foot unit it's got 6 meter eaves, and it was full to the brim of builder's rubbish. That was eight skips, just to empty the unit, eight skips.
And the manpower, but okay.
So that's what we inherited. So the one that I talked about first, which was the second deal, we did that fairly sort of quick. That was a quick 7 months blast. This one actually took us 2 years, and we did it a bit more steady. This is the first one. So what we did is effectively is we put a bit of our own money in at first, but then we used the profit rent over and above what we got, you know, after having paid the mortgage and what have you. We used the profit rent to pay for the renovations.
Yeah.
And you know, over time we upgraded all the electrics. We put a new car park in. You know, painted the whole place. Just renovating each unit piecemeal, basically, until we've renovated sort of 70% of the site now.
How many units was that one, Ryan?
48.
48. Is that how many it started as?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good number. Yeah. Okay. So you've used cash flow effectively to do the renovations.
Yes.
And when there was the 70K income, what was the sort of the vacancy rate at that point?
Oh, 80%.
Oh, really?
75%. There was hardly anyone there.
Yeah. Okay. So over that time, 2 years, which to me is actually quite quick.
Yeah.
I seem to take longer than that. But what's the occupancy like now?
100%.
Oh, fantastic. Great. Yeah.
So the rent roll now is 230 grand.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. 100% occupied. Do you think, are you still doing, or have you moved into more of an asset management phase now with those, because occupancy is 100% and there's opportunities?
I'll be honest, we sort of took our hands off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a little office down there, basically where we keep all our tools and odds and sods. Yes. And what have you. And it's basically where I'll go there once or twice a week to, basically, when my wife's working at home or she's got the day off or what have you, so I don't have to do the washing up, I'll go and escape down there. But broadly speaking, we don't go down there very often. Obviously, there's the ongoing thing of making sure tenants are paying the rent. And again, we have it managed, but we have a little bit more of a hands-on relationship with the tenants. You know,
sometimes
I'll call the tenants or drop them a text and say, look, you know, you're a bit behind on your rent. Is there any problems? Tenants coming and going, you know, because we have a lot of people doing car storage down there. And so, you know, I've got a tenant moving out next week, come to the end of his lease, and he's actually selling his vintage cars. He's bought an RV.
RV, yeah.
Yeah, he's bought an RV. So him and his wife now they've sold the vintage cars and they want to go and travel Europe. So he's moving out. So, you know, a couple of text messages to some of the existing tenants and, you know, I've got someone doing a back-to-back lease.
Yes.
So one of the other existing tenants has got a pal who wants some space to store cars.
Interesting. And Ryan, you used the word lease. What's your contract? What's the standard contract you're using then there?
Yeah, so we use 3-year leases with 18-month break clauses.
Yeah, okay.
Internal repairing only. So much in the same as the other one that we've turned into small units. Obviously, the one with 4 units, that they are straight up FRI leases with a service charge. That does have a proper service charge in place. It's horses for courses, Jerry.
Sure.
You know, if we started saying to people, look, you've got to pay your rent. The first property is VAT elected as well. Mm-hmm. So the one with 48 units. So you've got your rent plus VAT plus a service charge plus insurance. You know, oh God, we won't get any tenant. Yeah, and if we then start saying it's a 10-year lease,
yeah,
we would be 100%. We'd be 100% vacant.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a 3-year internal repairing only lease. So we pay for the insurance, and there's an 18-month break clause. And even then, we're actually very flexible. So sometimes we get people who need or want to leave early, and we just say that's fine. We'll re-advertise the unit. As soon as someone comes along, we'll back-to-back it.
Yes.
Again, yes.
So they're still technically covering the time up to somebody else moving in, but the back-to-back basically meaning they move out on Friday and the next tenant moves in...
Friday,
yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So we do it all very officially. You know, we'll all congregate in our little office. We'll get the outgoing tenant to sign a deed of surrender. And the incoming tenant to sign the lease.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's it. And that formalizes everything. You know, by this point, the incoming tenant has already given us their rent. They've already given us their deposit. You know, so we're covered from a monetary point of view. We're just back to back it. And then we just ask the outgoing tenant to pay for the agency fees.
Yeah. Okay. So that, just in terms of service charge for that first one, is there a separate electric meter?
So they're all submetered. That one, because of historic, you know, for legacy reasons, and that one, we've got the caretaker there. He actually goes round every month and does the meter readings.
Good.
I don't know why, but we never bothered putting automated SIM card readers in, which I recommend that everyone does. So it's, again, there's a big substation on site. Again, we pay for the head incoming electric, and then it's just all submetered further to that. The only thing we charge by way of a quote service charge there to be fair, is a security fee. So a couple of years, well, was it a couple of years ago, about 18 months ago, we had a bit of a problem with a few break-ins. And there is a local firm, they do one of these sort of deals where they will provide all the CCTV free of charge.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pay a monthly fee. But as well as that, it's a rapid response manned. So if there's any problems, it pops up on the, they've got little in-car screens.
Yeah.
Problem down at the works, a few lads in a Ford Focus will turn up and deal with the situation, shall we say.
Do you know if they've had many call-outs?
No. They put signs up, and these guys are fairly well known for, again, dealing with the situation. the CCTV, funnily enough, just gets turned off.
when they turn up
for 10 minutes and then turns back on and as if nothing happened
and everything's cleared away.
So these guys have got a bit of a reputation, and that's why they were recommended to us.
Fantastic. Right, that's been really interesting to talk about those deals. They've all been industrial. Is there anything that would tempt you into office, or do you feel you've got your furrow and that's where you're going to stick to?
Yeah, no, I like what I like. You know, industrial, there's, as you said, there's just such a massive pent-up demand, and especially at the smaller end of the market. The thing I like about industrial is, you know, I joke about this to pals who are not necessarily in the industry. I just give people white cubes.
Yeah.
I don't have to think about what worktop is in fashion this year or what color scheme. You know, is it anthracite grey, or is it, you know, sort of navy grey, or what? Yeah. You know, what colour? It's white. It's white. That's it. That's the only. It's like the old Ford, you know, Ford Model T thing, isn't it? What colour you're having? Black. But yeah, just give people white cubes, and it's easy. And there's such a pent up demand that I don't feel I should need to, as it were, move away from that.
Okay, so just on that then, do you feel that market is going to slow down anytime soon, or do you think that demand's going to continue? And I know that's a little bit of crystal ball, and it's more specifically industrial though, because there's obviously been a few changes in the world demographics that have led to this strong demand for industrial, but also just many years of underinvestment in that sector. A new build is really expensive, so it's just there's kind of the perfect storm there of that market. It's just how long you think that might last.
Oh, yeah, I mean, obviously, what's happened historically is that values weren't high enough to justify building.
Yeah.
And even though the values are now high, build costs have now shot up.
That's still catching up. Yeah, yeah.
So unless you are building the absolute monolith, you know, distribution hubs that are next to a big, massive motorway, you know, sort of the 300,000-500,000 square foot behemoths that only pension funds can possibly afford to invest in, you know, the values still aren't there to catch up to build costs. The project we bought recently, there is a little bit of land at the side as well that we are building on, but that's because it's free and the land, you know, the land came with the project. Yes. And so we can afford to put, we're putting 2,500 square foot there. Will things, and obviously it depends when we have the next recession, whether it's in sort of 6, 12, 18 months time or what have you. It depends how deep that is. I think, you know, will it effectively crystallize and solidify things further in terms of people moving away from traditional retail spaces? You know, because a good number of our occupiers at the first site are dark kitchens.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
So, you know, we've now got five, I think we have five dark kitchens on site.
Gee.
And so, are things just going to, you know, going to further go down that way, and obviously the high street's going to be more decimated in the next recession, who knows.
Consumer habits have what do they say, it takes 90 days to change a habit? Well, habits have had a lot longer to change, haven't they? So it could be that things will continue as they are. I wanted to just quickly touch on the off-market stuff. So just putting back on your valuer's hat for a second, how many and I'm not going to hold you to any specific percentage, but it would be good if you could just give us a guide. How many of the valuations do you think of off-market deals? That's transactions rather than just a revaluation.
I don't know. I was actually asked to quote on a job for secured lending a couple of days ago. Might have even been a day or two ago. Yeah. And that was a situation, yeah, alleged off-market transaction, and the person had an option on it. I don't actually know an answer to your question, Jerry, if I'm honest.
Yeah, because they're not always going to tell you, of course.
I think by and large, most people will try and sort of talk up the value and say, oh, I got this cheap, rather than say it was not. Because, I think there's a bit of a misnomer in the industry that surveyors and banks don't like off-market transactions for one reason or another. Yeah, I don't tend to find out, as it were, whether it's on market or off market as a transaction. Sometimes I do, but I don't think I can actually honestly answer your question with any degree of certainty.
Well, it's interesting the methods in which those three deals that you've done came across your desk. But with the off market transactions going on, I mean, my kind of prognosis of the agent network, which we discussed partly in our previous conversation, was about the fact that when a deal comes to market, sometimes the owner doesn't want it to be visible because they might be a little bit apprehensive about customers in the building learning about it. So they effectively, it's kind of on the market, but they just show it to other agents and people they know, as you say, that are willing to do transactions. They've got a track record and that's the way that they want to go. Mm. But the obvious consequence of that is that it can appear a bit like a closed shop for investors on the outside looking in. So, well, I didn't even hear about that deal because it was off market. And I guess that's just a symptom of it. But it's just interesting to see what your feelings on how many transactions actually go that route.
If no one knows about it, no one knows about it, do they? Yep. obviously, I possibly get to hear about one or two more than everyone else because I then go and value them.
Yes.
So I may not have had the opportunity to punt on them or quite frankly, the desire to punt on them. But nonetheless, I'll get to find out that it has sold if there's some lending in place. I suspect the answer is probably more than people realise. And certainly I've noticed just in the past month or two, there's been a few more receivership jobs.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Things that have been sold... or where people have needed to sell rather than wanted to sell.
Yeah.
And that's starting to creep in, especially as bounce back loans are starting, or certainly CBILS loans for the bigger bigger companies, especially as those loans are starting to get to be needing to be starting to be repaid, especially as interest rates are starting to go up and cost of living and all this sort of thing. I'm just starting to see a few more of those types of properties either come on the market via receivers or indeed, people needing needing effectively forced sales or indeed revalue, remortgages because they need some working capital in the business.
Yeah. So interestingly, that's not a consequence of the asset performing poorly or changing its performance. It's actually just because of the overarching factors like, as you say, CBIL loans, the conditions maybe for their trading business, and I guess
and bearing in mind some of these are owner occupied buildings as well, so they're not necessarily just investments.
Interesting. Okay, so just one last thing then on the off market stuff. Is there anything that investors can do to put themselves in the way of some of these deals?
As I've said before, speaking to agent, speaking to agents professionally, going in, arranging to meet them, and putting your best foot, making yourself look attractive.
Yeah.
Making sure that you have proof of funds. Be that in the form of deposits and in the way of if possible sort of bank lending. So yeah, just making yourself look attractive because at the end of the day, the agent wants, as with residential agents, the agent wants certainty. the and ultimately the vendor wants certainty, but the agent certainly, you know, at some point the agent's got to make a recommendation to their client,
yes,
to say you ought to proceed with John rather than Derek.
Yeah,
you know, and especially if you've got two competing bids. So I went to look at a property the other day with a view to buying it, and it was a receivership job.
Yeah.
And the agent explicitly said to me that the receivers aren't necessarily going to pick the highest bid. There's going to be a trade-off between certainty and price.
Okay.
And if we can go, if we can make ourselves appear more certain, then they're going to go with us rather than necessarily getting an extra 10 or 15 grand that's possibly going to come in 6 months once you've had two down valuations and, you know, you've not raised the deposit sufficiently and all that sort of jazz.
Yes.
Yes. And then this will only come with time. You know, if you're in at the point of doing your first deal, this isn't going to help you an awful lot, but completing,
yep,
doing the deals, you know, if you're known in the market, you know, and you don't have to be buying like 10 properties a month, just over the course of time, you know, looking at properties, offering sensible amounts on properties. And once you've had the offer accepted, completing in a timely manner, you know, pay a good solicitor who you know is going to answer the phone, who you know is going to respond to emails, who you know is going to, you know, not, don't just go for the cheapest solicitor who's going to drag things out and quite frankly, make you look bad as the investor.
Okay, so it's not always about the price offered. There's more to it when these bids are taken into consideration. You know, in terms of if you've gone to a closing date and you think, well, I don't know if I can offer enough, but if you present it, ideally, you know what the circumstances are, of course, of the vendor, but if you can present it in such a way that you outperform potential competitors, even if the price is slightly higher that they've offered, there's still a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a package deal. You know, sometimes the vendor just wants absolute top dollar. No questions asked. They don't want anything else other than every last single penny out of the building.
Yeah.
Sometimes, like I said, that fixed charge receiver, they are obviously looking to sort of absolve themselves in terms of their legal responsibilities, in terms of maximizing the amount for creditors. But nonetheless, they have to balance that against actually getting money in.
Yeah.
Because for a fixed charge receiver, they are personally responsible whilst it's in receivership. That's the law. They want the certainty. Are you ready, willing, and able to complete?
Yeah.
In a timely fashion. It's just case by case. Speak to the agent. If doing a subject to planning deal is a potential option, and then you do it, and then you get planning, and you go, and then you complete. Happy days. If the vendor wants a cash offer, don't start faffing around, you know, putting forward all these weird and wonderful ideas. The vendor may need the cash for whatever reason.
Okay. So I've got two things left to cover here, Ryan. The first is a bit of a mash. It's kind of what opportunities are you observing in the market right now? But I'm going to lead that slightly. I'm just going to ask, are you seeing more activity in flexible space? Is there an increasing use of flexible contracts or a desire for flexible contracts? Or is that's not really popping up on the radar too much?
And, you know, the RICS put out sort of periodic publications as to average lease lengths. Yeah. And since I started as a surveyor in 2010, that has just come down and down and down and down. I can't remember off the top of my head what the latest
number is. Yeah.
Last time I looked, it was sub 6 years.
Yeah.
As an average, and bearing in mind that takes account of all the big, you know, massive spaces, these purpose-built monolith properties where it's 25, 30 year lease, you know, so you've got a lot of properties that are sub 6 years to pull the average down. And so, yeah, I mean, naturally, the smaller tenants, again, your serviced office operators in terms of your occupiers, you know, the sort of the smaller end of the industrial market where I operate, they want a, you know, they want a shorter term lease, yeah. Because they don't know what's going to happen, especially if we go into a recession. They want to be able to pull out. You tend to find that retail operators want a little bit of a longer lease because there's a certain amount of capex,
yes,
involved, yeah, in setting it up, getting it ready for their particular branding and all that sort of stuff. So they'll be happier with a sort of 3 to 5 year lease, even the individuals, because they think, well, I'm going to spend 20 grand getting the shop nice, again, bigger the property, longer the lease. It's a very crude rule of thumb, but it broadly works.
Yeah, is that capital expenditure, yeah. So is there any sort of opportunities you're kind of starting to observe in the market right now, or is it still a little bit sit on your hands? What's your thoughts?
Funny enough, I was having this conversation with my pals a few weeks ago, and we were saying, you know, do we just keep our powder dry?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said it the other day, it might have been on a Clubhouse thing, or it may have even been on Facebook that I saw it. And you know, the phrase that was very, very prevalent in the financial crisis, cash is king.
Yep. People starting to...
And that phrase is starting to get battered around, you know, a fair amount more than I feel comfortable with. cash is king. And so, you know, do you do something now for the sake of feeling as if you ought to? But maybe, I don't know, maybe you're buying at the top of the market.
You know? I think if there's uncertainty, prices are likely to either stay the same or change direction.
Mm.
And the more uncertainty there is, the more that you probably can pause. But that's not to say there aren't still deals out there.
Mm. No, absolutely. Yeah. At the end of the day, you've got to make sure things stack. You know, I always do this with myself, and I always advise clients or, you know, the people I'm chatting to or who are maybe a little bit newer to the commercial space than I am. Be conservative. If things work, if the numbers stack on a conservative basis, I'm not talking about being stupidly conservative here, you know, sort of like offensive, you know, making offensively low offers. But if it works on a fairly conservative, you know, nice and steady, if it works on that level, then everything else is cream on the cake.
Yeah.
You know, everything else above, you know, if you get an extra 25, 50 for 75 pound a square foot on the rent, whatever. And if you manage to get half, three quarters of a percent lower on the yield, then that's all good, and that's all money in your back pocket. I'd be in terms of extra income or extra equity or extra money you can pull out, depending on which bank you go with and which skin in the game the bank manager wants you to have and all this sort of jazz. But you know, all that is just all fantastic. But if you're forcing yourself to do a deal and it only works at the absolute top end of the rent scales that's likely, and it only works at the bottom end of the yield capitalization, it doesn't take much for things to go very wrong. You, if you do a little sensitivity analysis and drop the rent by 50p and put the yield up by a quarter of it or half a percent, you know, things can go very wrong, and you may not be able to pay investors back. You may not be able to pay your bridging finance off, or you may not be able to recapitalize the out of your first deal into your 25-year mortgage or what have you. You can be in hot water.
So let's after that cautionary tale, let's finish on a positive note. So people do ask me, is it possible to do a BRRRR strategy, a buy, you know, redevelop, rent out and refinance on commercial property? Mm. And it certainly seems that your experience from the properties that you've dealt with, that is absolutely possible.
Yes, with another cautionary note.
Yeah, go.
It depends which bank you go with.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned the phrase just a second ago, skin in the game.
Yeah.
That is a favorite phrase of many a bank manager. You know, some of them who are a little bit longer in the tooth and not fresh out of university have lived through and worked through the financial crisis. And they literally had clients or borrowers and investors coming back and saying, there you go, there's the keys there. I'm in negative equity, you can have the keys back. And they were like, oh, well, you know, what's happening here, sort of thing. And it's because the borrower, the investor, didn't have any of their own personal funds tied up in the investment.
Yes.
And so the first property...
to lose.
Yeah, exactly. So the first property I mentioned, the one, the 48 units, we certainly didn't cash out of it. Now, fortunately, we didn't use much of our own money in doing the renovation. It was all effectively foregone rent, foregone profit. We ended up at about 30% loan to value after we refinanced it.
Yep.
And that's because the bank said, okay, well, we'll give you 60% of the purchase price plus 60% of your costs.
Yes. Not 60% of the value.
Yeah. Well, that's ridiculous. Like, we've got an asset that's worth, again, comfortably 2 million quid, and you're offering us 700 grand.
Yeah.
You know, how does that even compute? And so, yeah, that's what, yeah. So we ended up doing it with that particular one, and we just accepted that we were on a ridiculously, you know, we got a mortgage at 2.24 percent plus Bank of England base rate. Whereas other properties, the second one, we were able to completely cash out, do a straight up buy rent refinance model. Again, we left about 50 grand in that particular one, in the one that we took back to Brick.
Yeah.
But we went with Cambridge and Counties, who are a bit more flexible, a bit more expensive on the interest rate, nonetheless. Yes. But just be cautious, or you know, speak to your broker at length and ask really deep questions. Because a broker we were going to go with on that second property, Lloyd's will definitely do it. They'll, you know, they'll allow you to refinance. Sent all the paperwork in. Came back a week later. Oh, you've only spent this much money, and why are you telling us it's worth 1.6 million? You've only spent 850 grand. It's like, well, we know that. Like, you know, just as a by the way, you ask me as a chartered surveyor to do valuations for you.
Yes.
Like,
the shoe is on the other foot.
I'm sure that you trust me to do valuations for you. You know, all right, I know you're going to have it valued by someone else independently anyway, nonetheless. But I'm telling you, this is the value of the property. Oh, well, we can't really do that because you've not spent enough money. There's no skin in the game,
isn't it? Yeah.
No skin in there. So just again, I'm sorry, I can't end on a massively happy, flowery note. But you know, practicality comes first, unfortunately. So yeah, make sure you know who you're lending with and what their criteria are.
But it is, from what you say, it is possible.
It's definitely possible. Definitely possible.
And interesting, the way that we've done it is not by refinancing and taking a lump sum, because part of the question from the finance lender will be, well, what are you going to do with this money? So what we've tended to do is use the extra value as leverage. We've not actually we haven't done the process of let's refinance, take the money, now go invest in something else physically. We've taken the asset and given security over it for the next purchase, with security over the next purchase, which has allowed the leverage there, rather than necessarily taking the actual money out, which I think some people from residential feel that's the way you do. Or you must get the money back, pay off your investors, and then you take the money and use it as a deposit for the next one. It doesn't have to be that way in commercial.
Yeah, that can be a slightly more complicated or a little bit more intricate way of doing things, in that if you have either a group structure or you have everything wrapped up in one company, and then you can sort of, you can do cross collateralizations and debentures and what have you across various properties, and indeed if you've got a nice group structure going on with an umbrella company at the top, you can cross charge between the whole lot and what have you. Probably a different conversation for a different day.
Of course, yeah, and there's a risk associated with that.
Yeah,
because you're all.
Very much certainly possible. You know, especially if you don't necessarily need the money straight away. You know, if you don't need to pay back any investors or bridging finance straight away, and you can just sort of sit on it for 3 or 4 or 6 months until you find your next deal, and then you go and say, right, I now need some cash.
Yes.
In whatever way, I now need a bit of cash to go and buy this new property, which I'll be bringing to you as a bank anyway. You'll be getting the debt. Don't worry. But I just need a bit of cash from that other property I can, you know, bring it forward.
Yeah. That just goes to prove there are many ways of doing these transactions, right?
Yes.
Many different ways.
Many ways to skin a cat.
Yeah, indeed. Right, Ryan, this has been super. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your industrial experience. That's been really interesting. And the CMO model you've been doing there with multiple units and not necessarily all with their own separate supplies and everything else and all different utilities and toilets and everything. It's been really quite interesting to see how that's worked for you. I'd be quite interested to come and have a look at some of those properties. They sound really good.
If you're in South Yorkshire, give me a call. I'd be happy to show you around.
Right, Ryan. We will put your details in the podcast notes. Anybody listening that wants to have a chat with Ryan, reach out. Ryan will go up to the Pennines, and he will go a couple hours north and a couple hours south for anyone that feels they would like to have a conversation with Ryan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Speak to you again soon, Ryan. Thanks.
Cheers, Jerry. Bye-bye.
Hi there. I hope you're enjoying the content delivered on the CPI podcast. Even though it's free to listen to, it actually takes quite a bit of time and financial commitment to deliver each and every episode. Did you know that by leaving a positive written review, you, yes, you, will have a direct impact on the visibility of the podcast? And that's really important, because by reaching a wider audience, it helps our team to continually improve the overall content that we deliver to you week after week. For some of you, leaving a review will be second nature, but for others, it might be your first one. Open your podcast app, pick the CPI podcast, and search for previous reviews. And on iTunes in particular, click to look at all of the reviews, and then you'll see an option to leave a written review. Go on, it'll only take 2 minutes, and it'll really make our day. And we genuinely read every single one of them.